Welcome to the Earned First podcast. This is Arun Sudhaman, founding editor of Earned First. And I'm really happy to be joined today by Isabel Demord from the Hoffman Agency. Isabel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Arun. It's great to be here.
So we are going to talk about your session at Praxis Asia Pacific earlier this week. So it took place 3 days ago, although by the time people hear this, it may well have been around a week. But it was a fascinating discussion, like many of the sessions at Praxis. You were focusing specifically on credibility as PR's new superpower. And you had a very interesting panel, I thought, as well. You had Alisa Chopard from LinkedIn, head of communications for Asia and Japan. You had Stephanie Yu, Asia Pacific communications leader at Lenovo. And you had Puneet Singh, who's the head of communications for Asia Pacific at ByteDance. And I wonder if perhaps you could get us underway, perhaps by just giving us a little context into just the sort of idea behind the panel itself and what you were looking to uncover.
Well, I think that's a great question. And I think what it boiled down to for us at the beginning was a discussion around what does it mean to be credible in today's landscape? There was a story that inspired me personally a good, it must be about 6 months, 9 months old now. But I don't know if you'll remember that a few months ago when AI content was really starting to reach that inflection point and everyone seemed to be using an AI tool in their content creation, there was a saga that seemed to spark on LinkedIn called the M-dash witch hunt, for lack of a better term. I don't know if you know about this. But I've posted on LinkedIn.
I think
quite
it's still ongoing. I feel like it's still ongoing.
I don't think everyone's up in arms about it as much anymore, but it's definitely a thing, and I'm still really conscious about it. For people who aren't aware that it had a name, because I didn't know that it was called an M dash, but the M dash is the hyphen's longer cousin.
I
also like to think it's good grammar, and creates lovely, beautiful content, but I come from a copywriting and editorial background, so of course I think this. However, the other people who also really like grammar, or the other thing that also really likes grammatical accuracy, is AI. And so the M-dash was considered a hallmark of whether someone had generated their content on social media using generative AI tools or not. And we started seeing a spark of outrage in people's comment sections when they had identified M-dashes in people's content, saying, you didn't write this, this isn't your voice, a robot, an algorithm has developed this content for you, etc. And I mean, we can go into grammatical pedantry as much as we want, but I don't think that that's the point of this example. I think the point is that we have gotten to a stage where we are praising AI for its efficiency, its productivity, what it's going to be able to do for the communications industry in terms of being able to move us towards a more strategic direction, where our council deserves to be at the board and at the table, etc. But communications very often boils down to what people are reading and absorbing about our opinions and our convictions. And if people can't believe that you wrote something or that you actually stand behind a conviction, then suddenly it's not the information that's being brought into question, it's the authorship. And whether they can believe in you as an individual when you're leaning on AI tools to write those opinions for you. So I think the exploration that we had during the panel was, is this where we've come to as a society now, where leaning on an AI tool is going to completely erode trust? Or is there a way to balance the fact that the landscape is changing and it's changing very, very quickly, but still hold on to the core of what PR is all about, which is creating trust, creating reputation, and creating influence? So it was really, that was really the exploration that we were trying to undertake.
It's a really interesting question. How did your panel respond to that, first of all? Did you find any particular dissent, perhaps, around this idea that credibility is in question because people are concerned about authorship, they are concerned about AI slop, perhaps they're concerned about MDASHs? What were the responses like?
I think the general consensus was people agreed that they had that this was coming into question, that people's credibility was being shaken by the fact that AI is in the mix. Without naming names, one of the panelists identified a very large consulting firm recently who had to refund a very large portion of a project that I think they did for a government agency, if memory serves. And the refund came about because it became very, very apparent that they had developed this huge report on the back of AI. And it's completely shaken the faith in the brand. And I thought that that was very interesting, that we're getting actually very large conversations starting to circle around this, that people are really scrutinizing, did you do this, yes or no? So I think the panel was on board in terms of, yes, this is definitely an issue. This is definitely a question that's coming up at a much larger frequency these days. But I think that the line that really spoke to me, and I think that captures the general sentiment that I think not only the panel shared, but it felt like the general room shared, was that the basis of what makes us credible has not changed. Because in order to be credible, you need to have a stance, you need to have conviction, you need people to trust what it is that you're saying. AI is a tool. And if you misuse the tool and people start scrutinizing you, well, so be it, but it's a tool. It shouldn't be what is forming the basis of what makes you credible, yes or no. And I thought that that was a really good place to kind of springboard from in terms of the rest of the conversation.
You also asked, as I recall, the panelists whether earned is making a comeback.
Yes.
There's at least two ways of looking at that particular question, I suppose. The first, of course, is that if credibility becomes more important, then presumably, you know, that goes hand in hand with earning it, because it's hard to buy credibility and it's hard to pay for it. It's something I think that has to be earned in a way. And of course, in terms of classic public relations, it's something you rely on. Whether it's kind of advocacy at scale or whether it's through third-party endorsement. But of course, the second thing, which is maybe more of a newer phenomenon, is the rise of GEO and the impact that authoritative media sources is having on LLM search, which would seem to indicate that earned is making a comeback, something we've heard really all year. As a kind of potential savior for the public relations industry, if apparently it needs saving. I didn't think there was really consensus around this question, right? There was some disagreement.
There was not.
Whether earned is making...
disagreement.
Yeah. So what did you make of that? Take us through that, perhaps.
Well, we had both ends of the spectrum on the panel where... one of the panelists in particular was very adamant that earned is not making a comeback, that the media landscape and the way that we consume insights and information is already so fragmented these days that probably people are not going to make that swing back to earned, and that they're just going to continue finding new ways of consuming information that's not necessarily, at least not in the traditionalist sense, the way that you would look at earned media. I would still argue, because this particular panelist, she was speaking about the importance of community value and community voices. And I would argue that that is a form of earned.
I was in the crowd thinking that. Yeah.
So I believe that that is a form of earned, personally, because you don't shape community voices and community interpretations without having really merited that space in their minds. I believe that that does fit into that remit. But if we put that to one side, I think one of the other panelists thought that actually we might be getting to that inflection point where Earned hasn't made its dramatic comeback to victory as of yet, but that it's probably on the horizon, because the more that people, again, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, the more that people do start to question authorship and whether something is true judgment, truly intentional, and represents what someone thinks. If it's on an owned platform, if it's something that you pushed out into the world, whether there's no way of really fact checking it or verifying just how much or how little it really truly represents you. And I would even say, even because I know there are things like AI detection tools now, and even that I would say is not representative of whether it's someone's opinion or not. Because you, if I give a personal anecdote, I post a lot on LinkedIn, and I am very open about the fact that I use ChatGPT as basically my LinkedIn editor. And so I suspect that if you put my posts through an AI detection tool, it would come up as relatively high. But that also wouldn't surprise me, because the way that I work with ChatGPT is I speak into it. All my stories, my observations, my anecdotes, my half-formed thoughts, the calls to action that I think I want people to take away from this. And basically, because I tend to be very flowery with my words, I say, okay, take all of this and turn it into something that is structured and legible for a LinkedIn community, because it's not going to be, you can't capture every single word that I would normally put in a sentence otherwise. I need someone to rein me in. And so I use ChatGPT to do that. Mm-hmm. I would 100% stand behind every single post that I have ever written. That is every opinion that I've had, every stance that I've got, every conviction that I've got, that is 100% me. But if you're just looking at it from a tool perspective, you wouldn't necessarily think that. So that was a very long tangent, but coming back to the other panelist who thought that Earned is at the inflection point, essentially the point that he was trying to make was, when we don't know what to trust anymore, Earned Media, we know there's been some rigor that's gone behind being able to secure that spot. And so if you have managed to get that all glorious opportunity in whatever publication or new media outlet that there may be out there, if you've managed to do that and you've done it, done so in an earned way, then you've earned your stripes. And people should be able to lean into that as at least one credible, trustworthy source in a world that is otherwise inundated with stuff that you don't know where you sit.
Yeah. It's interesting as well, because there's so much nuance to this, this whole conversation, because yes, you could say that Earned becomes more important thanks to the influence of LLMs, thanks to the influence of more authoritative media, but it will look different in different markets, in different contexts, potentially in different sectors as well. And it's not going to be, I think, a simple approach necessarily. In fact, it may well be more complicated. From a kind of geographic perspective, do you think that there are questions around how that nuance is going to play out to help brands land credibly in different markets? I mean, I presume that's something you see every day in Asia anyway.
Yeah, every single day. So something, I don't know whether you know this about me, Arun, because I know we've known each other for a long time now, but I'm currently studying for all intents and purposes, a master's in cultural intelligence, which is exactly, it's this topic. And it's looking at how you, it's how you bridge perspectives and divides from people who come from significantly different backgrounds. So it's not necessarily, I think culture sometimes is a misnomer, because we think, when we say culture, we immediately think to national identities or ethnic identities. But you can have a lot of different things that shape culture. Tribes. It could be your generation. It could be your organizational culture. It could be religious beliefs. It could even be things like your sexuality and what different types of communities that you belong to. And every single one of these things adds a layer to someone's identity that you have to bridge. I think nations and the unwritten societal rules that we have are one of the big ones to bridge. But really, when you are trying to connect with anyone and trying to share a message, then you are having to read the room and read the cues that they're giving you and adapt your message accordingly. But if I boil it down to something that is a bit more simplistic, I remember working with a client and their organization was headquartered in the US, was having some difficulties in one of the local markets here in Asia Pacific. And there was a lot of talk that they were going to have to shut down operations in this particular market. And that came with a lot of anger from local users. Now, the local agency on ground was essentially urging this company, if you want to make amends with your user base and you want to have them on side, then you need to go out there and you need to create an apology. You need to have an apology. And the US firm was saying, well, we can't apologize because otherwise we're liable. The legal team's going to come in, etc. And we haven't done anything wrong. Whereas my team was trying to say, well, culturally speaking, it's not about liability. It's not about whether you've done anything right or wrong. It's in our culture, we apologize first and follow up with all the facts and the realities of the situation later, but you apologize first. Otherwise, you burn the bridge. Unfortunately, in this particular case, the organization did not take heed, did not listen to the local council. And lo and behold, the backlash was quite significant. So they lost a lot of face and a lot of credibility in the region because they weren't willing to, I don't know whether it's that they weren't willing to bridge that cultural divide or whether they genuinely felt like their hands were tied. Maybe it was more the latter than the former, but the point being that lack of nuance led to a significant downturn for the organization in Asia Pacific. And that was a real shame because otherwise they had a very loyal fan base here and people who really supported the brand.
Mm. And when that collision happens, I think we're used to seeing global winning, not to reduce this to a binary, but we're used to seeing perhaps global prevail. We're also used to seeing the lawyers prevail. But if corporates and brands do want to be credible in the markets and communities that they serve, they need to become more culturally intelligent. Do you see evidence that that's happening? Was there anything on the panel that perhaps encouraged you in that belief?
I wonder if what I'm about to say is politically correct.
Until you say it.
There you go. I would say, so what I've been living in Asia Pacific now, I've been living in Asia almost 10 years. And I am married into an Asian household. And I would say that I don't think I truly understood what it meant to be culturally intelligent until I was more exposed to this side of the world. And it seems to be like breathing in Asia, that you would take a moment to consider what is the perspective of someone who comes from a different background to myself. I'm not necessarily saying that therefore Asia gets it right all the time, not at all. But I do think that there is that pause and that moment of consideration of, do I need to be approaching this differently? And I didn't necessarily see that as much when I was based back in the UK. I don't think this was anything malicious or intentional, not by no means. But I don't think that curiosity necessarily is abundant in every interaction that I was in. So when you say, do I see change on the horizon? I would say that Asia Pacific, in my view, has always been pretty strong in this area. There's room for improvement. There's room for growth. And I especially think as we see Asian economies increasingly growing and becoming the leading global economies, I think someone mentioned it during the event at some point that we're looking at in the next, was it 5 to 10 years, something like that, like 7 of Asia's economies being in the top 10 global economies worldwide.
Yeah, I think I'm sure someone said four of the top five. Maybe don't.
And four of the
quote
top
me
five,
on
yeah, you're absolutely right. But I think they expanded it to seven of the top 10. I mean, it's here. So the more that we see Asian organizations going out of Asia and looking at their global trajectory, the more that we may start to see the reverse effect of having to really bridge a culture that is very, very significantly different to yours. But I would say that the particularly the geopolitical landscape that we're in right now does not lend itself very well to a very culturally intelligent world. Because everything is so polarized right now, because everything is gravitating towards nationalism and protecting your own, which is understandable because there are lots and lots of things that are happening that are beyond people's control. At the same time, I would say that maybe I'm speaking selfishly here, but cultural intelligence for me is one of the most important skill sets that anyone could be acquiring right now from a communication standpoint, because no matter what we do, no matter how much we resist globalization, the supply chain is already there. Like our supply chains are so diversified. We are so interconnected as a society, as humanity, that we cannot possibly escape the need to interact with people who are very different to us. So I truly think that that's going to be the mark of incredible communicators and incredible leadership in the years to come, in the very soon to come years, I would say.
So my follow-up to that would be, you had three very interesting brands on the panel, right? You had ByteDance, who are well known for being the company behind TikTok, a company that has been in the headlines for, let's say, cultural and political reasons in recent times. It is, of course, a Chinese company. It's banned where I live in India. It's banned where I used to live in Hong Kong as well, which I always think is quite amusing. Maybe I'll eventually live somewhere where TikTok is legal. You have LinkedIn.
Lens on.
Actually,
I'd love to see you doing TikTok videos, Arun. That would be very entertaining.
Hey, you never know, man. You never know.
I don't know exactly. So please enlighten
never
me.
Rule it out. No, I think I'm quite glad that I don't necessarily have to interact on another platform, just for now. You had LinkedIn, of course, which has become the kind of premier B2B social network, and then you have Lenovo, which once upon a time was a Chinese company, is now very global. Of course, it bought IBM. You know, IBM's PC business, wasn't it, many years ago, and so it was kind of melded into a really quite a unique company, I think, in terms of its sort of geographic profile. Did you get a sense from any of them that they are grappling with these questions around cultural legitimacy and intelligence, and it's changing how they think about credibility in different markets?
I didn't get a particularly intense sense from any of the panelists at that time that it was something that they were heavily considering. Of course, there are certain organizations among them that have had to face this, at least in the past, and looking at that cultural legitimacy. What I would say that the panelists brought to the table was the sense of, I guess, because all of them have been in the region for a very long time and understand the region very well, that they were very quick to the mark in terms of, you cannot possibly treat Asia Pacific as one region. You can't. It is so diverse, so fragmented, that even having spent extensive time in any given market does not therefore preclude that you are an expert in said market. And really that you should be taking the time to lean into people who are truly experts, who are truly local, and are going to be able to give you that perspective that otherwise you would not be able to get. So I think there was a real candidness about how complex it is to do communications in Asia Pacific and how carefully you may have to tread if you truly want to make impact here. That was the resounding sentiment that I got from the panel.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's an important consideration as well, right? Just take care, because that's also not something that always happens, I think. There is often, you know, there's a rush, there's a haste. And in this new AI-dominated world, we can produce so much content. And I will often wonder, the more we produce, is it being accompanied by the same level of care always? Yeah. That equation, you know, can become a little lopsided, which is not ideal. You asked what PR superpower will be in the next decade. What will humans do better than machines? Was there anything that we will do better than machines?
Well, I think the idea of doubling down on our humanity was what everyone seemed to agree on. So two of the panelists in particular, they seem to be, it's funny because they were the ones that had the most opposing views at several points. And yet on this last point, what is going to be PR superpower? They both unanimously agreed that it's the fact that we're able to listen. And I think one of the panelists captured it very beautifully, this ability to discern. The thing is, AI can give you reams and reams and reams of content. It's a fantastic brainstorming partner. It's fantastic at creating content to fill the void and to fill the spaces, particularly if your brain is feeling tired and fried and you can't think, how do I put something together? And I need to put it together quickly. But, and we've seen people fall on the wrong side of this as well already. AI cannot tell you what is ultimately going to be the right course of action for you because it cannot read the room, at least not in its current guise. It cannot read the room. It cannot be there with you, noticing the subtle cues that we're getting from tone, from body language, from just understanding the person and their background, etc. It can't do that. And so being that mediator between, okay, I've got all this content and all these ideas that it's thrown my way, but what is the golden thread here and what actually makes sense? If any of this makes sense, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it needs more reiterations, a lot more refinement. Maybe it needs an extra insight or piece of strategic counsel that it was completely lacking and that turns the whole thing on its head, etc. AI is not going to be able to capture that. It can't. And so that's where I think, not just as an industry of communications professionals, but as a society in general, when we're thinking about the skills that future generations are going to need, then that for me is the one that stands out on top. It's how much do you understand your fellow human? How curious are you about them? And are you going to be the one that helps to bridge the gap? Or are you going to be the one that turns a blind eye and just pushes content out? I think the people who have that moment to think will be infinitely higher up the chain than those who just take it and push.
We can't forget the relationship aspect of public relations. And, you know, yes, AI tools are very good at many things, but how good are they at building, maintaining, protecting, and enhancing human relationships, which is kind of what you had alluded to that several points in your last response, right? You know, understanding context, the history of a relationship, why people react, how they do, and perhaps even the impact of culture as well. So yes, I do think that relationship aspect sometimes gets forgotten.
It's funny, isn't it? Because it really is. It's the foundation of everything that we do in PR. But
yeah,
I guess in recent years, the way that tooling has moved in PR, and this isn't an excuse, it shouldn't be an excuse, but the way that tooling has moved is, say you now have databases where journalists' email, contacts, details, etc. are listed. And sure, that makes a distribution far easier. But
then
you scale, see people skipping the step of, did you actually read what the journalist writes? Like, do you know that's been a voice? They care about.
Do you understand their kind of, how they work, what makes them tick? It's interesting, isn't it? It's kind of, in this sort of arms race towards content distribution at scale, content production, it's very easy to forget that human aspect. So I'm glad to hear the panelists did reinforce this idea of humanity, and I'm hopeful that that bodes well. And then just finally to close, you did ask about cancel culture.
I did.
And about companies. you threw that one in at the end. I think I did give them a heads up.
I will say in my defense, I gave them a heads up. They were good sports and decided to come along for the ride. But it was by far the prickliest question that I could have asked.
So are companies still willing to take a stance in today's polarized environment where people get cancelled at the drop of a hat and there's so much backlash, it seems, against, wokeism for one thing, purpose for another, ESG perhaps in certain places?
I find all of this painful because I am taking over the diversity and culture group in the PRCA, the industry trade body. Yeah.
At least they still have a diversity and culture.
They do. We held firm. But it is. It's quite a scary landscape out there at the moment in terms of just holding true to things that you think are important values. Because all of these values suddenly have become political topics where you either stand on one side of the argument or you stand on the other side of the argument, and apparently there's nothing in the middle. And I personally disagree with that, but I do think the panelists were very real, if I would have said slightly pessimistic, in terms of how corporates can respond in this environment, which is, if you choose to take a stance as a corporate, you have to accept the fact that you are going to bear some sort of repercussion. And so the question that you need to be asking yourself is the repercussion worth it? I personally, if I add my own opinion in though, while I entirely agree with what they're saying, and I do see a lot of corporates now trying to dilute their stances to make it more palatable, I don't necessarily think that that means you therefore have no opinion or no conviction. I think this boils back down to, it's not necessarily about the conviction that you have so much as how you say it. And that is ultimately the hallmark of a good communicator and a good spokesperson, is if they're able to navigate that fine line between, I have a belief, but I'm also thinking about how the audience is going to receive that belief. And how can I influence them to at least be open-minded and hear me out? Not necessarily to change their minds, but to make it something that is acceptable to them, that they can digest, that they can walk away, and at least feel like they had a thought that was provoked. I think that that is the ultimate challenge as we move into the coming years in PR. How can you make sure that you still stand for something and that you don't all sound the same? Because if AI is good at one thing, it's great at replicating structures and vocabulary. And so what you tend to find with AI generated content is that it all starts to merge and blend after a certain period of time. And you can start to sense whether something is really grounding this piece of content or whether it's a bit of fluff to get you through tough times. So the way that I look at it is, corporates don't need to be either 100% or nothing. I would say you're able to find the status quo and deviate from the status quo, even call it 10 degrees, 15 degrees. That would be enough to show that you stand out from the crowd and to show that you have something in you that you want to share, but without completely alienating an entire audience. I would say one final thing that I think of here is a conversation that I had with Lou Hoffman last time he was in town in Asia Pacific. And this is a belief he's held for a long time, but I truly buy into this as well. it is better that 70% of the world loves you and 30% of the world hates you than 90% of the world thinks that you are fine, inoffensive. Because if you are inoffensive, it also means that you are meaningless. Like, people don't mind whether you come or you go. If we're trying to work with organizations who are looking to build their brand and build their influence among whatever stakeholders they find important to them, you don't want to just be one of many. You want to be the one that stands out, and the one that is appealing to them. There's one final, I can think of a quote by a lady that I really like. Her name's Juliana Chan, and she is a very, very on LinkedIn in Singapore. But she also uses the magnet theory of, you have to attract, if you're going to attract, then you have to repel. So I think it's a similar concept.
Yeah, exactly. Either you stand for something or you fall for nothing, I think.
Yes.
But it's interesting what you said about the, moving 10 degrees, 15 degrees. My immediate response was, that's just not going to be far enough for lots of people. And that creates another problem.
But I think it's better than what people are doing, or what I see a lot of people doing right now, which is to just stay at zero, because zero is safe.
Yeah.
Zero means that you're not going to have anyone coming with their cancel pitchforks and saying you did it wrong, because what have they got to hold against you?
Yeah.
So even 10 degrees, 15 degrees can feel like a brave step for I'm talking particularly from a corporate perspective. When you're looking at individuals, maybe you want to take even more of a bold stance to make yourself stand out.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's different when you're not necessarily being held against a bottom line and profitability and commercials, that you're not looking after an organization that employs thousands and thousands of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
10 degrees can feel like a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's plenty here to be hopeful about. So thank you for that.
Thank you. I'm glad you felt so.
Yeah, I did. I really enjoyed the discussion, and I really felt that it kind of reflected, I think, an industry that is getting to grips with some of these questions, much more than perhaps 12 months ago, when I think there was, or even 6 months ago, when I think there has been a lot more angst. Of course, a lot of the angst is deserved, and we shouldn't shy away from it. But I'm relatively reassured that we are thinking about these questions and coming up with pretty good responses and models for how to behave and how to respond. So thank you for that. Thank you very much for moderating the session on Tuesday.
And
it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Arun. It's been a lot of fun.